Well, I don't think we got off of slide 5, did we? But I can't remember where in it we are. So we mentioned Golgi, but not yet lysosome. Did I finish with Golgi?
It says on Golgi, left off.
Okay, the Golgi complex or the Golgi apparatus, it's called either one, is this cyan-colored organelle, and just based on appearance, you might mistake it for the blue one, which is the rough endoplasmic reticulum, except even if there weren't any color difference in this cartoon, you can notice that there aren't ribosomes associated with the surface of the Golgi complex. Those ribosomes are what give the roughness appearance to the rough endoplasmic reticulum. So yeah, it's also a system of flattened sacs made out of membrane, like the rough ER is, but the Golgi complex has a totally different function. It operates as a receiving and shipping center, just like at a factory, basically. You know, there will be two places, a shipping center somewhere on the grounds and a receiving center. Trucks that are there, that come there to deliver stuff to the factory, go to receiving, right? Trucks that are going to take away whatever the factory manufactures are leaving from shipping. Similarly for the Golgi complex, that has a receiving function, and what it receives is packages of newly modified proteins. Well, what did I already say is the organelle responsible for modifying brand new proteins? What organelle does that? No, ribosomes are responsible for manufacturing polypeptides, one amino acid at a time. And they're associated with the rough endoplasmic reticulum because as they build those polypeptides, the polypeptides get strung into the lumen or hollow interior of the rough endoplasmic reticulum, whose job it is to modify them. So that was the answer to my question. It's the rough endoplasmic reticulum that modifies the brand new proteins in some way so that they can function. And then the rough endoplasmic reticulum packages them and sends those packages to the nearby, which is why it is nearby, Golgi complex that receives them. Okay, so receiving those packages from the rough ER is one function of the Golgi. But the reason it's receiving them is because its main function is to then figure out where these modified proteins need to go. And that's the shipping aspect of the Golgi complex. And it depends on the protein. But the Golgi figures that out and then packages them again, just like it's different boxes that are put onto trucks for shipping compared to the boxes that are coming in as raw materials, right? It packages them again and sends those packages on their way. The packages, by the way, both incoming and outgoing, are in the form of little vesicles, which is a little sac made out of membrane. Okay, we'll see greater detail of that when we look at the Golgi complex in a different slide in isolation. Let's go on to the next one clockwise, which is the lysosome. Well, I shouldn't say the lysosome. There can be any number of them. But a lysosome is itself really a vesicle. Vesicle simply means a little bag made out of membrane. But the lysosome is a specialized membrane-bounded organelle, even though it's a small one. Its name means literally splitting body. Lyse, as in lysis, means split. And soma means body. And that's a good name for it because what is contained inside the lysosome are hydrolytic enzymes. Hydrolytic is just the adjective of hydrolysis. So enzymes that speed up hydrolysis reactions. We've already talked about hydrolysis reactions, right? What do those do? Well, yes, but water is has to be added for a hydrolysis reaction. That's true. But what is the intent, in a sense? What's accomplished? No, that's just the opposite. That's dehydration reactions. Right. I just said lysis means splitting. Hydrolysis, which is hydrolysis, is the splitting of big things into smaller pieces. It's the opposite of dehydration. So in other words, things get digested or broken into smaller chunks within a lysosome. Why within a lysosome? Well, these hydrolytic enzymes that are in there are dangerous things to have floating around in the normal cytoplasm, right? Because they can start breaking apart things that you don't really want to break apart in the cell, namely structures in the cell. So they're safely housed in little vesicles by themselves called lysosomes so that they won't do any damage. We'll see one of these in action later. Next up is the mitochondrion, or a mitochondrion. That's the singular word. The plural is mitochondria, A instead of O-N. And there are, in a typical eukaryotic cell, multiple mitochondria within the cell. You can see four right here, these orange bean-shaped things. Well, this is the second example that I'll give you of three of a multiply membrane-bounded organelle. The first was the nucleus, remember. The nuclear envelope consists of two membranes. Well, so does the mitochondrion. It has two membranes associated with it. And we'll see a closer view later, and you can even see the membranes better there. But the overall purpose, the main purpose of the mitochondrion is to conduct a complex set of chemical reactions collectively called cellular respiration. And we'll look at cellular respiration in detail in Unit 3 after this upcoming test. That's Unit 3 is typically the most challenging part of the course. But anyway, that's what goes on in there. And what cellular respiration is all about, I'll give you the details later, is maximizing the amount of usable energy extracted from fuel molecules that start out in food, but eventually become just molecules of fuel in the cell. Okay, next up, peroxisome. And to look at it, it would be hard to tell it apart from a lysosome. Very similar, it also includes enzymes that need to be kept away from the rest of the cell, but in this case, those enzymes are for a different function. Peroxisomes get their name because the enzymes they contain are responsible for degrading and thereby making safe various kinds of molecules that are called reactive oxygen species, or ROS. And there's different versions of these, but peroxides are examples of reactive oxygen species. Things that have oxygen in them, but highly reactive forms of oxygen, which then can easily react with other things and cause damage. And so when you hear on commercials or just in the news or whatever about antioxidants being so big now in people's health regimens, those are things that are taken as supplements to help deal with these reactive oxygen species. They're the ROS, these reactive oxygen species, are continuously being made as a normal part of metabolism, but they can be damaging if they build up, so lysosomes try to keep them in check. Peroxisomes. All right, next we have microvilli. Micro, of course, means small. Villi is the plural of villus. It would be U.S. ending for just one of these. A villus, just the word by itself, means a finger-like projection. And you can see each one of these kind of looks like a finger. So microvilli are just small finger-like projections because they're projections from a single cell, therefore microscopic. But notice that they really are just elaborations or folds in the plasma membrane. And when I said that this is kind of a catch-all picture last time, this is a good example of something that not every kind of animal cell is going to have. It might have them, it might not. But why would you have a bunch of folds in these finger-like projections called microvilli? What would that accomplish? Any ideas? Well, it could, but that's not their purpose.
Maybe when things go into the cell, would not take baths with it?
That's a good idea, but that's also not exactly what it is. When you fold something back and forth, you're really fitting a lot of more material than you would need to, right? So microvilli drastically increase the surface area compared to it just being smooth. For instance, if you think of, notice it's a cutaway view of this cell. If you imagine this edge of the plasma membrane being the beach on an island, the cell is the island, you could walk along the beach, right? But if you have to stay on the beach and you have to go from A to B right here, on this part, the smooth part, it's pretty much a straight shot, right? But if you go along this part of the beach, the same overall direct distance, but you have to stay on the beach, that's a hell of a lot longer walk, right? There's a lot more membrane. So microvilli increase the surface area without actually increasing the volume of the cell very much. And therefore, for something that needs things that are embedded in membrane to work, the more membrane you have, the better. The perfect example in your own body are the cells that make up the endothelial lining, the inner lining of your small intestine. By the time it's no longer food, it's called chyme at that point. By the time the chyme gets to the small intestine, it's already been digested. That's been done earlier. Well, it hasn't completely digested. This small intestine digests as well. But anyway, it's still outside of your body. The inside of your alimentary canal, the tube from mouth to anus, is not in your body. Your body's wrapped around it. It's not until it actually goes into the cells of your body, which is what absorption is, is it actually in your body? And that's the main job of the small intestine. If it absorbs the now small enough digested pieces, molecules, into your body. To do that means to crossing a bunch of plasma membranes to get them in those cells before it's sent to the bloodstream. And that requires proteins that are embedded in membranes because they can't otherwise cross the phospholipid bilayer. Therefore, the more membrane you have, the more proteins you can embed in that membrane to transport that stuff. And the small intestine has to kind of be in a hurry because it's all that stuff is passing through you. You can't wait. If you're going to extract the useful stuff by absorbing it, you have to do it while it's there before it leaves your body as feces. So that's why we evolved by natural selection to maximize the surface area, which does a much better job. All right. Next up, are these three things under the all caps header cytoskeleton? The cytoskeleton is literally, as the name says, the cell skeleton, the skeleton of the cell. Now, it's not a bony skeleton like our overall endoskeleton is, but it is a skeleton because it's a framework. Kind of like the girders of a building is a skeleton. It keeps things arranged, for one thing. But also importantly, it serves as a system of roadways along which things can be moved from one place in the cell to another. And the cytoskeleton overall is made up of a system of proteins, fibrous proteins, which means long, right? That come in three categories. That's why you see the colon here after cytoskeleton. The three protein components of the cytoskeleton are microfilaments, intermediate filaments, and microtubules. And we'll look at those in their own slide to compare them. You get a better view of them. But they're all proteins. The next one is centrosome, which is not a well-defined structure you can point at. I want to say that the centrosome, despite this little bracket, is not this T-shaped yellow thing. You see the T-shaped yellow thing? That's not the centrosome. The centrosome is the kind of yellow halo around it. Notice it's kind of glowing. That's the centrosome. Eukaryotic cells in general, this is an animal cell, but of course we are eukaryotes. Eukaryotic cells in general have centrosomes, and they are microtubule organizing centers. So I just mentioned microtubules as part of the cytoskeleton. In this figure, these yellow things, strands, are microtubules, and notice they're all growing out from the centrosome. There's only one centrosome at the moment, but when this cell is about to split, there will be two. And so centrosomes are important for cell divisions in the form of mitosis and meiosis that we'll study later. But in both of those cases, they are microtubule organizing centers. Now, the T-shaped thing is made out of two protein complexes, each of which looks like a little licorice chunk, arranged in a T pattern. And those proteins are called centrioles. So it's confusing because they're so similar in names. But centrioles, the licorice T-shaped things, are found in animal cells, but not in plant cells. Centrioles are part of the centrosome in an animal cell, but not in a plant cell, as we'll see when we go to the plant cell in the next slide. Now, not only that, but I can't really tell you what centrioles are for, because we haven't figured it out. In fact, we've been able to experimentally remove them from animal cells, and nothing seems to go wrong when we do that. They're still able to undergo mitosis, which the centrosome is all about. So, and also plants don't have them, and they undergo mitosis just fine. I don't really know why they're there, but there's a lot of things in science we don't know yet. Anyway, that's the centrosome, and in an animal cell it contains centrioles. And then we have the flagellum here, this long whip-like tail. This is another example of something that has been put on there, but not all animal cells will have that. Especially because animals are multicellular organisms, and a flagellum is usually part of a cell that is free-living, just living as a single cell. But there are human examples. What's an example of a flagellated human cell, a human cell with a flagellum? No ideas? What kind of human cell lives by itself as a single cell? What is it? Well, it is true that they are not directly connected to other things, so that's a good example, but they're not flagellated. Sperm are, though. And a sperm really is a unicellular organism, really. It's really not you. It has its own genetic ploidy. We'll get into all that later. But anyway, yes, that's a human sperm are flagellated. A flagellum, if it's on a cell, is a locomotory device. It's a whip that when it moves, propels that cell through the liquid medium in which it lives. And so that completes the clockwise treatment of that. Let's go on to the similar looking slide 6. It's similar in that it's also a catch-all, so not every plant cell is going to have all of these necessarily. But this is a plant cell as opposed to an animal cell, so there are some differences. There's also a bunch of similarities, so I'm not going to go through the same things that I've already talked about in animal cells when it's in the plant cells as well. Those things do the same job in plants and animals, like Golgi and endoplasmic reticulum and so on. But there are some important differences things that plants have that animal cells don't. For instance, a cell wall, which you can see is clearly thicker, and that's what makes it stronger, than the plasma membrane, which is the yellow sheet. Every cell has to have a plasma membrane. That's what defines the cell. But plant cells are examples of organisms, or plants are examples of organisms that have cell walls exterior to the plasma membrane, much thicker, much comparatively rigid, and they hold in the pressure like we were talking about in the lab. So that's why they do well in a hypotonic environment. The water's continuously trying to come in, but the cell wall holds it, holds the pressure, makes them turgid. Another difference is that plant cells feature a central vacuole, typically, which is this huge thing that looks empty in the picture. And in fact, that's why it's called a vacuole. Vacuole and vesicle are really two names for the same thing, a bag made out of membrane. But a vacuole is bigger than a vesicle. That's one difference. The reason it's called a vacuole is because the word vacuous means empty. A vacuum is empty space. Well, that's a misnomer, though, because it's not actually empty. It just looks like there's nothing there in a microscope slide. It's water, mostly. It's at least water. But it can contain other things as well, like pigments, for instance. In certain kinds of cells, you can easily see the central vacuole because it'll be the only thing colored in there. Plant can also use the central vacuole more or less as a waste dump. In other words, to store something, puts things in there that it wants to get away from the cytoplasm in its own little compartment. But it's mostly water. And plants don't have to manufacture water, right? They don't build water. They get it just by osmosis from the soil. And since the central vacuoles occupy such a big portion of the overall volume of a cell, and since it just comes in by osmosis, it doesn't have to be built by the plant, this is one reason why plants can grow so much quicker than animals in a lot of cases. You know, a sprout can overnight get an inch tall. Well, that's not a cell getting big, that's cells giving rise to many, many more cells, right? But since each of those cells individually can be mostly water in a central vacuole, it's easier to build. You don't have to manufacture all the stuff that's in a cell like an animal cell. So they grow a little quicker. We also see plasmodesmata. That's a plural word. The singular is just plasmodesma, without the TA. Plasmodesmata are what they appear to be in this cartoon, little tunnels running through the thickness of the cell wall between two cells and thereby linking two plant cells together so that the things that are the right kinds of particles, the right size and the right chemical composition, can get through the plasmodesma from one cell to the next. Notice, though, that it's not just a hole in the cell wall. This yellow sheet, remember, is the plasma membrane. So this is the plasma membrane of this cell officially, but notice that plasma membrane wraps into and becomes continuous with the inner lining of the plasmodesma, the tunnel. and then will continue as part of the plasma membrane of the next cell. So we talk about a plant having individual cells. We recognize this is its own cell and the next one is its own cell. But they really are all one compartment joined by a bunch of tunnels throughout the body of the plant, trillions of cells big. So that allows for communication. Exchange of materials through a plasmodesma is communication from one cell to the next. Various things can go through, like hormones, for instance. Okay, is there anything we... Oh, of course, the conspicuous green things are important in plants, plant cells. Those are chloroplasts. And that's the third of three examples I'll give you of a multiply membrane-bounded organelle. So we had the nuclear envelope of the nucleus. That's two membranes. The mitochondrion is two membranes. And the chloroplast also is. Keep in mind, by the way, that the plant cell has both chloroplasts and mitochondria. Animal cells have mitochondria, but not chloroplasts. And why is that? What's the job overall of the chloroplast? Photosynthesis, which we'll study in the same unit as cellular respiration, the stuff that's going on inside a mitochondrion, the stuff that's going on inside a chloroplast is photosynthesis, though. And so we'll talk about the particulars in that chapter later after this upcoming test. But for now, let's just say that photosynthesis is a complex set of biochemical reactions that use energy from sunlight to power the production of organic molecules from inorganic molecules. And those organic molecules can then either be used as fuel, so that that's how a plant feeds itself, it creates the food, or those organic molecules can also be used as building blocks to build other organic molecules. Basically the same reason we use food. We eat not only for fuel, but for raw materials to build our molecules. Plants do it by themselves, and that's why plants ecologically are producers. Everything else besides producers is consumers. Consumers rely on producers to feed them. Producers feed themselves. Okay. I think everything else has already been mentioned in the animal version. Yes, it has. So we can go on to 7 and look at these organelles in closer detail. Slide 7 is kind of 2-in-1 because it shows the nucleus and the endoplasmic reticulum, but it makes sense to show those two together because of what I mentioned in the last time, which is that the outer membrane of the two making up the nuclear envelope folds out here and there, here you're seeing it happen right here, to become the membrane making up the endoplasmic reticulum, which is recognized as a separate organelle, but it's really connected membrane-wise. And that's why it's changing from purple to blue. That's just the color scheme of the book, of course. But purple means nucleus, blue means endoplasmic reticulum. And you get a good view of a couple things here, namely the nuclear pores. Those are complexes of proteins arranged into little tunnels on the nucleus, which allows for passage of things into or out of the nucleus. And then various things go through those, but one important thing that needs nuclear pores, I've already mentioned when we talked about transcription and translation earlier. Transcription has to happen where the DNA is, because that's what transcription is, reading the DNA's code to make a messenger RNA molecule. So in a eukaryotic cell, the DNA is in the nucleus. That's where transcription occurs, meaning that that's where mRNA is created. But mRNA's job, once it's created, is to serve as the instructions for a ribosome to build a polypeptide. And those are out in the cytoplasm. So the messenger RNA needs to get out of the nucleus through nuclear pores. It does that. You can also get a good view of the fact that the rough ER gets its rough name because it is studded with a bunch of, in this case, brown ribosomes. Ribosomes, each ribosome is its own organelle, but there's a bunch of them associated with the surface, membrane surface of the rough endoplasmic reticulum. And that makes sense, because what did I just say a ribosome's job is? Right. Ribosomes are little molecular machines that actually assemble the polypeptides in any cell, one amino acid at a time. So they make those peptide bonds that we're talking about to turn individual beads into a string of beads. Well, it makes sense that these ribosomes, these protein-making machines, are associated with the rough endoplasmic reticulum, because the job of the rough endoplasmic reticulum is what?
To send the protein to me.
Not to send them yet. First, it has an important job before it sends them.
Create them?
Not create them. Ribosomes create them.
Package.
Modify them before they're packaged. So just because you make a polypeptide, which is what the ribosome does not mean that polypeptide or protein is ready to do its job. Some of them need to be modified after they're off the assembly line. But the assembly line is the ribosome itself. And so by associating themselves with the rough ER's membrane, as they make that string of amino acids longer and longer, it gets strung into the lumen or hollow interior of the rough endoplasmic reticulum, where it can then be modified by the rough ER. That's the job of the rough ER. After it does that job, then it packages them and sends them to the Golgi complex. Okay, let's look at that in slide 8. Well, a ribosome, let's look at a ribosome. So this is really close up, because this brown thing is one of those tiny brown dots in all the other figures. A ribosome is an organelle, but it's a tiny one. And remember, it is not a membrane-bounded organelle. It's really just a mixture of RNA and protein. We'll talk about that later. But the single ribosome, there's many, many ribosomes, but a single ribosome, as you can see, is made up of two major parts, two subunits, a large and a small. And this slide is really telling you a lie when you get down to it, because a ribosome, the two subunits that make up a ribosome, aren't actually together like this picture by themselves. This ribosome doesn't become a complete ribosome until and unless a messenger RNA comes along and connects to one of them, namely the small subunit, which then causes it to be attached to a large subunit with a messenger RNA in between. So you wouldn't see it like this, really. It's just showing you this for simplicity. Also, each small subunit is the same as any other small subunit. The same can be said for the large subunit. So they're modular devices, which means this large subunit is not always going to be with this particular small subunit. Next time it's used for translating a messenger RNA into a protein, it could be any other small subunit that comes along and binds to it. They're all interchangeable parts. Now, the phrases that you see above the cartoon, free ribosomes and bound ribosomes, do not refer to different kinds of ribosomes. They're all the same ribosomes. As a matter of fact, bound ribosomes used to be free ribosomes. What free ribosomes refers to is ribosomes that are not attached to a membrane. They are just free on their own in the cytosol, which is the liquid part of the cytoplasm. And that's how all ribosomes come together to start building a polypeptide to begin with, as free ribosomes. After they've started the process of linking amino acids together, so you have part of a polypeptide built, some of those are then signaled to become associated with the rough endoplasmic reticulum's membrane, so that the rest of the protein can be put into the completed protein can be put into the rough ER for modification. So that's when the free ribosomes are then called bound ribosomes, because they are attached to a membrane. And that's why you see so many attached to the rough ER, giving it its roughness. But that's a temporary association. The ribosomes that are on the rough ER are just the ribosomes at the moment that are on the rough ER. As soon as they're done completing their polypeptide and stringing it into the ER, they will not only detach from the membrane of the ER, but the two subunits will detach, and then they'll be back in the pool, ready to be used again if another messenger RNA comes along. So it's always different ribosomes at any given moment that are on the rough ER. 9. Another view of the nuclear envelope's relationship with the rough ER, but the new information here that you didn't get a good picture of before, is the packaging. So remember, we just said that the job mainly of the rough ER is to modify the proteins after they're built. But then once that modification is done, whatever it is, which depends on the protein, then a little piece of membrane from the rough ER itself buds off into a vesicle to make that package containing the modified proteins. And that vesicle then travels to the nearby Golgi complex so that it can receive that package of modified proteins. And so this is just one example of the fact that membrane material, first of all, is basically the same stuff, whether it's plasma membrane or membrane-bound organelle membrane. It's continuously being moved around between plasma membrane, rough endoplasmic reticulum, and Golgi complex, little pieces of it. So it's vesicles move membrane. It's blue here still because that means it's officially still part of the rough ER. But we'll see that this blue vesicle is now going to fuse with the cyan-colored Golgi membrane and become part of the Golgi complex. That's shown in slide 10. Notice it's still blue at the moment, but it's fusing with the cyan membrane of the Golgi complex. The Golgi complex, remember, is the receiving and shipping center. So there are two important jobs, and those two important jobs are done at different ends of the organelle. Which means, that's why we call this a polar or polarized organelle. It has nothing to do with charge. It just means there are ends that are different from each other, like north and south pole. So the receiving end, that's why I call it a receiving and shipping center rather than a shipping receiving, because receiving comes first. The receiving end is labeled as the cis face, and the shipping end, the trans face. Cis and trans, just like we used to distinguish geometric isomers with the double bonds that can't twist. Cis means same side, trans means other side. So the cis face, which is the receiving end of the Golgi complex, is the part that is right up against, in that overall figure we looked at of the animal cell, right up against the blue endoplasmic reticulum. So the vesicle that buds off, this blue vesicle that came from the rough ER, doesn't have to travel very far to the right next door Golgi complex. And since it's membrane material, and all membrane material is mostly lipid because of the phospholipids, all of which is really trying to avoid water, it kind of coalesces into other membrane material, just easily kind of melts into it, just like if you have droplets of oil on water and they happen to get close to each other, they will coalesce into one bigger drop because they're all trying to stay away from water and huddle into the middle of themselves. So that's why this happens, this fusion of the vesicle into the Golgi. Well, that brings the contents of the vesicle, which are these already modified proteins, to the Golgi, so that the Golgi can do its job of figuring out where those proteins, depending on what they are, need to go. Okay, so it receives them, they're already modified, now it needs to figure out where they need to go, and that involves packaging them in a new vesicle, which is formed by a budding off of membrane from the Golgi. That's why this is a cyan-colored vesicle. It came from Golgi membrane. And send them on their way. That happens at the shipping end, which is the transface. We'll get a view of some possibilities of what happens to them in a different slide. 11. Okay, now think all the way back to Tuesday when we had lab. I mentioned that there are three major transport processes that can put things into or out of a cell. Do you remember what those are? Or any of the three? No, those aren't processes. Those describe solutions having to do with osmosis, which is one example of one of the categories. Three major categories of transport processes, things that can put things into or out of cells. Active transport,
passive,
and
vesicular.
And vesicular transport, exactly. Vesicular is simply the adjective of vesicle. So vesicular transport is a way to get something either into a cell or out of the cell using a vesicle to do so. And I can't remember whether I mentioned it to you or not, but vesicular transport is kind of a cheating mechanism because normally, to get something into or out of the cell, you would need to cross the boundary, right, which is the plasma membrane. And active and passive transport can both do that. Things actually go through the membrane, either into or out of the cell. But vesicular transport allows something to either come in or go out without that thing actually ever going through a membrane. And before we get to the picture, let's just say that vesicular transport is the biggest term, the most inclusive term. It includes all transport via a vesicle. But there are two categories of vesicular transport, and the only difference between them is the direction of travel of the material, whether it's into or out of the cell. So vesicular transport is either endocytosis, which is vesicular transport into a cell, or exocytosis, which is vesicular transport out of a cell. It doesn't matter what kind of stuff it is. If it's inward, it's endocytosis. Outward, exocytosis. Endocytosis, which is already a subdivision of vesicular transport, can then be further broken down into two kinds, one of which is shown in A here, phagocytosis. Now, cyte means what? Cell. Osis means condition. What about the phago? It's the same root as in the word esophagus, which is the food tube, right? Your tube leading to your stomach. So the phag part means eat. And phagocytosis literally means condition of cell eating. You can see here that this molecule that can be used as fuel, so basically food, is being taken into the cell, but it doesn't cross a membrane. Instead, the plasma membrane forms an in-pocketing and surrounds the food particle until it eventually seals off, it pinches off and completes the bag, which is this vesicle, and the plasma membrane just seals itself. Now that food particle is in the cell, but it never crossed a membrane, right? And the reverse can happen for exocytosis without ever crossing the membrane. But back to the word phagocytosis, that is cell eating, literally. Well, that means endocytosis of a solid chunk or chunks. But the cell can do exactly the same thing with a liquid. It can basically take a little sip of the environment into a vesicle. And we therefore, since it's a liquid instead of a solid, we give it a different name, which is pinocytosis, P-I-N-O, which means drink. So cell drinking and cell eating. They're both endocytosis, though, because they both bring things into the cell. Look what happens when this phagocytosis, though. Once you have the food vacuole, and since it is food or fuel that needs to be broken down to extract energy, it needs to be chemically digested, in other words, you need to expose it to chemicals acting as digestive enzymes, which, like I said, for the lysosome, when we described it before, is dangerous stuff, right? So it's safely housed in this lysosome, but lysosome is made of the same kind of membrane as the food vacuole, and therefore they can easily be fused together, exposing the digestive enzymes to just the thing you want to break down and not the other parts of the cell. On the right-hand side, we see a similar process, except this isn't breaking down something that came into the cell as food. This is autophagy, the same PHAG meaning eat, auto means self. So this is self-eating, literally, is what it means. But autophagy is a way to basically get rid of old, worn-out organelles and use them for their raw materials rather than just wasting them. This is a mitochondrion that has seen better days, no longer useful as a mitochondrion, but it's made of a bunch of organic molecules that can be used as subunits for building other stuff. So you dismantle it just like a junkyard does with autophagy by exposing it to enzymes that will safely break it down in its own vacuole, and then you have the raw materials. 12. No new information here, but we've already looked at a cartoon version of the central vacuole and seen that it can occupy a large part of the volume of a cell. Well, this is a real photograph, an electron micrograph, and you can see the central vacuole can be huge, which is why I was saying plants can grow quickly. 13. Now we get a better view of the packaging that's done by the Golgi complex. It receives packages, first of all, but those packages came from the rough ER. They fuse in to deliver the modified proteins to the Golgi. It figures out where they need to go and then packages them in new vesicles made out of Golgi membrane. And notice that membrane then is going to become part of the plasma membrane. So membrane material is moving around all the time. There's two major possibilities here if this vesicle fuses with the plasma membrane, only one of which is shown here. Notice that these modified proteins, the purple dots, are fully inside the vesicle. So when the vesicle fuses with the plasma membrane and then spreads out, it's now officially part of the plasma membrane, right? The membrane itself is. But since those were fully inside, they're going to get spilled out of the whole cell, which is appropriate for certain proteins. That's how proteins become extracellular proteins. They can't be built outside. It takes a cell to build them. But some proteins are supposed to work outside the cell, so they need to be exported. Another possibility, though, you just have to imagine it since it's not in this picture, is that some of these modified proteins are different ones in a different vesicle, could be actually embedded in the membrane of the vesicle rather than fully inside the bag. And if that happens and the same fusion of the vesicle to the plasma membrane happens, then when it spreads out, now those proteins that used to be in the vesicle membrane are part of the plasma membrane. And this is how cells adjust moment to moment how many and what types of proteins are in the plasma membrane, which is always changing. The whole cell is continuously changing, highly dynamic. 14. Nice close-up view of a mitochondrion. You can clearly see that it has two membranes now. And the outer membrane of a mitochondrion is actually smaller than the inner membrane. The outer membrane is really just big enough for it to be a smooth covering, as big as it needs to be. But the inner membrane is bigger because it has a lot of folds in it. So in terms of material, there's a lot more membrane there. And there's many folds. Each individual fold is called a crista, without the E. Plural is cristae. So there are many cristae in the inner membrane. Now, why would you have these folds? More surface area. Exactly. Just like the microvilli. if having more membrane allows you to have more things embedded in that membrane to do a job, then it's worth doing. And that's exactly what happens with the mitochondrion. As well, when we talk in a different unit about what goes on in cellular respiration, we'll see that it involves embedding a lot of things in this membrane. Therefore, the more you have, the better. It does a more efficient job of cellular respiration. But since there are two membranes in a mitochondrion, there are two separate chambers within the mitochondrion. The mitochondrion is already separate from the cytoplasm, right? But inside the mitochondrion itself, there are separate chambers. There's one compartment called the intermembrane space, which just literally means between the membranes, so between the outer and the inner membrane right here, all of that. But then there's the compartment that's fully inside the inner membrane. And all of that stuff collectively is called the matrix, the mitochondrial matrix. And so we'll talk about its importance when we get to the cellular respiration chapter, but we're just looking at anatomy right here, pretty much. Notice, though, that the mitochondrion has its own ribosomes. And they really are its own. They are different from the ribosomes, chemically different, from the ribosomes in the main cytoplasm. And that's because of how mitochondria came to be evolutionarily in the first eukaryotic cells. They were originally, mitochondria were originally free-living bacteria that got engulfed as food. Something was eating them by cells engulfing the smaller bacterial cells. And for whatever reason, in some instances, they didn't get killed by that, and they just kept living inside the cell. Another example of endosymbiosis, like with the bacteria in the cow, only this is a cell within a cell. And those became mitochondria. Bacteria living on their own have to have ribosomes for the same reason, right, to build proteins. Well, microscopically, molecularly, the ribosomes in bacteria are different from the ribosomes in eukaryotes. And in our own cells, or any eukaryotic cells, the ribosomes in the main compartment of the cell are actually eukaryotic ribosomes, and the ribosomes that are in mitochondria are almost identical to bacterial ribosomes that still exist in free-living bacteria. So it's really good bit of evidence that this is really how they came about, the so-called endosymbiotic theory. Okay, let's go to 15, which is a chloroplast. Now, we give names to three membranes in a chloroplast, but depending on who you ask, it's really either two or three membranes. I call it two. There is an outer membrane by name and an inner membrane with that name, just like for the mitochondrion. But then we give a third name, the thylakoid membrane, which is all the membrane making up the green in this figure. The reason I don't count that as actually a third membrane is because the inner membrane actually folds in and becomes the thylakoid membrane. But anyway, there's three membrane names, whether you count it as two or three distinct membranes. Now, the green part is called the thylakoid membrane because each individual coin-looking thing is a thylakoid. And notice they're not just single coins, they're stacks. A stack of thylakoids is called a granum. That's a singular word. But there are several stacks. The plural of granum is grana. So a single chloroplast contains several grana, each of which is a stack of thylakoids. And they look like separate coins, but as you see here in the cutaway view, they're really all the same membrane elaborately folded back and forth. But there are three spaces in a chloroplast. There's also an intermembrane space between outer and inner membrane, like a mitochondrion. Then there is stuff called the stroma, which is the fluid inside the inner membrane, but outside of all the thylakoids. And then there's the fluid that's inside the thylakoids, which we call the thylakoid space. But we'll revisit those when we focus on photosynthesis later. 16 is just a photo micrograph of a plant cell, just to show you that it's not just a cartoon. There really are thylakoids arranged in neat stacks, and they're connected to each other by membrane. 17. Okay, here we're looking at two of the three cytoskeletal elements. Remember, there were microtubules, microfilaments, and intermediate filaments. Microtubules are the largest diameter of those three. You can see the thickness there. Microfilaments are the smallest diameter of the three. They're slender. And intermediate filaments, not shown here, got their name simply because they're a diameter somewhere in between the two extremes. But they do different jobs, and we'll compare them when we look at a chart in a second. 18 shows you microtubules in cartoon form at the top. They're called microtubules, not rods, because they are hollow. They're like little pipes. And when I mentioned that a major function of the cytoskeleton is to serve as a system of roadways, that specifically is the job of microtubules. And you can see in cartoon form a little person-shaped structure with two legs walking along a microtubule. And it really seems like, well, that's just a cartoon. But that's more or less what they are in reality. Here's the real thing. With two legs, they take one step at a time along the microtubule, each time using ATP to power that step. But the reason they're doing that is not to just take a walk. They are carrying a vesicle, the motor proteins they're called. Each motor protein is carrying a vesicle, which is the cargo that needs to be moved from one place in the cell to another. Now in 19, we get a view side by side of the three kinds of cytoskeletal proteins. And you can see that microtubules are the biggest diameter. Microfilaments, smallest, and intermediate filaments, somewhere in between. Intermediate filaments, more or less, are structural elements. They're like cables or ropes. They're strong. Microtubules, I just told you, are important for transporting things from inside the cell to another place in the same cell. But they're also really important in mitosis and meiosis that we'll study later. And microfilaments of different types interact with each other in such a way to cause deformation of the cell. This happens, this is how your whole muscular system works. Skeletal muscles only do one thing. They can pull, but they're connected to bone, so when they pull, they move the skeleton in different ways. But the muscle cells get shorter, not because the microfilaments get shorter, but because the different types of microfilaments overlap more and more. But you can also use that same scheme, basically, interaction between microfilaments, to just change the shape of a cell for other reasons besides being in muscles. You see a couple examples of those, I think, coming up after 20. First, in 20, though, we're looking at a close-up of the centrosome once again. No new information here, just the same stuff. This is an animal centrosome because it has centrioles. A plant centrosome would otherwise be the same for the same purpose as a microtubule organizing center, but it wouldn't have the centrioles. 21. Here we compare two categories of locomotory appendages, flagella and cilia. We already talked about a flagellum, which is the singular. They're pretty long compared to cilia, so that's one difference. Flagella are much longer than cilia. Another example, and remember, no individual cell has to have either one of these. But another difference is that if a cell is flagellated, if it has a flagellum, it will typically have just one or a small number of them at just one end of the cell, like a human sperm, you can see here. Because the intent is to propel that cell in one direction through the medium. On the other hand, if a cell is ciliated, then there are many cilia, and usually over most, if not all, of the surface area of the cell, not just at one end. Now, both of them are locomotory devices, so they can both propel the cell through the medium. We already talked about that for flagellum. If a cell is a free-living cell, living on its own, not attached to other things, in other words, and it's ciliated, then the beating back and forth of the cilia can cause it to tumble through the liquid medium, getting from A to B. But you also have ciliated cells that are attached to other cells. In other words, that are part of a multicellular organism like our own body. A perfect example of this is the endothelial lining of the trachea, which is the windpipe, leads to the bronchi and then eventually to the lungs. Lungs are delicate structures internally. So you don't want to get debris in there. You want to get the air in there, but not the solid particles that are in the air, which includes not only just solid debris that's non-living, you know, dirt and stuff, but also potentially pathogenic living things. Bacteria are in the air as well. So that's why the lining, the cells that form the lining in the inside of the trachea produce mucus, for one thing, and they are also ciliated. Now, mucus is sticky. That's why it's produced. As the air passes by, the solid chunks, which are much bigger than the gas molecules, easily stick to the mucus. So a bunch of it gets caught before it gets into the lungs. That's a good, of course, but you can't just have a permanent sheet of mucus, right? It would be like using one of those rollers to pick up lint. They eventually get full. So the cells are ciliated, and those cilia are continuously beating. And that's not about propelling the cell through a medium. That's about moving the medium, which is the mucus layer, across the cell itself. They're continuously sweeping the mucus, which has bad stuff stuck to it, upward to your throat, and you throughout the day you swallow, continuously sending all that stuff to the most inhospitable place in your body, which is your stomach. It will get digested, and hopefully it will kill the bacteria because they can't tolerate the acid. Okay, let's go to 22 and look at a cilium in molecular detail. Any given cilium is made up of a system of microtubules, which are proteins, as we've said, and also these red motor proteins, which are just the same kind of motor proteins that we saw walking along carrying stuff. But here they're used for a different purpose. They function the same way. They move one step at a time. But notice there's an army of them. And this will lead to the bending of a cilium, but that's really explained in the next slide, 23. If you have two microtubules side by side, and one microtubule has motor proteins connected to it, so it's like the cargo of all of these at once, and then the other microtubule is being walked along, as you see here, if you imagine that happening, then it's just going to slip the two microtubules next to each other, as you see in the figure. But if I use two pieces of paper to represent that, I think it's more clear. Pretty easy to imagine the slipping. But these are not connected to each other. So if I just walk one along the other, they just extend like that. But that's not how cilia operate. They need to bend. So there are other proteins, these blue ones, holding the microtubules together. And that would be like using one piece of paper bent, right? Now the two are connected. And if I try to slide them past each other, it bends instead of just slipping. So that's how the cilia beat back and forth, by those motor proteins walking along adjacent motor or microtubules. All right, 24. Picture of the cytoskeleton again, so not really any new information, but you can see that proteins making up the cytoskeleton are pretty elaborate and pervasive, and they even go into the microvilli that we talked about earlier. This is membrane, the covering of the microvillus, but these are proteins inside. Number 25 is some examples of the microfilament actions that I was talking about earlier. The top is how your skeletal muscles work. So an individual muscle cell, which is very long, the whole length of the muscle, is made up of a bunch of subunits called sarcomeres that are end-to-end. But from this gray to this gray is one sarcomere. And there are two different kinds of microfilaments in there, actin and myosin, that don't get shorter themselves. They stay the same length. But they increase their overlap between each other. And since one of the two types is connected to these end plates, that brings the end plates closer to each other. And the same thing is happening at the same time in all the sarcomeres. So it's like the whole muscle cell is like a train made up of a bunch of cars. If you simultaneously make each train car half as long, you just like that make the entire train half as long. And that's how muscles shorten. But the same interaction can be used to just deform the shape of the cell, like in an amoeba, which is always changing shape, right? It's walking around on what are called pseudopodia, false feet, by bulging part of itself out and then drawing it back to walk along. That's all because of actin and myosin microfilaments as well. And in a plant cell, the same mechanism is used in what is called cytoplasmic streaming, which you can easily see if you put a living plant cell on a slide in a microscope, especially because there's a light source on the microscope. So that's going to cause the cytoplasmic streaming. You'll see the chloroplast start moving around, basically trying to get close to the light. Number 26, no new information at all. It's just a different version of showing these plasmodesmata, but you can clearly see that it's joining one cell to the next. In the last slide, only one cell was shown. Anyway, plasmodesmata are examples of what are called intercellular junctions, which is a phrase that simply means a joining between two cells. So plants have these basic one type of intercellular junctions that we're going to talk about in this course. Those are the plasmodesmata. We'll see some animal versions in a minute. 27. This is a view of just a little piece of plasma membrane of a cell. So this is the interior, and you can see the cytoskeletal proteins. Well, these purple blobs are proteins that are membrane-bound, right? They are part of the membrane. And then there are a bunch of proteins that were exported from the cell, making up part of the extracellular matrix. And notice it's all connected. Some of these proteins that are extracellular are connected to some of these membrane-bound proteins, which in turn are connected to the cytoskeletal proteins. This is a flimsy plasma membrane, but connecting all these proteins is kind of like strain relief. Because if something gets pulled, you're pulling on the protein, pulling on a protein, pulling on a protein, which are strong. It's not necessarily going to rupture this phospholipid bilayer. Number 28 is also no new information, but it's a real photograph to show you that these plasmodesmata actually do exist, and they go through the cell wall just as the cartoon showed. Now we can look at animal intercellular junctions in 29. There's a few of them I'm going to show you. First, though, notice where we are here. This is the interior of a cell that's been cut away, so the whole cell would come out and continue around. And you can see a cell on either side of it as well. The first one I want to talk about, first intercellular junction, is a desmosome, and there's several desmosomes shown. Each of these intercellular junctions, by the way, is really just a complex of proteins. But a desmosome, notice, is partly in one cell and partly in the next cell, and it's connected. It's all connected. At just particular places, though, just like spot welds on sheet metal. Do you know what I mean by spot welds? Instead of welding the whole thing together, you're just welding together little spots, but it'll hold the two sheets together. That's how car bodies are made. That's exactly what desmosomes are doing as a function. They're operating as spot welds to hold adjacent cells in animal tissues together, keeping them from changing positions, basically. so they're strong. A complex of proteins between cells, but for a different reason and a different arrangement, are the gap junctions, little tunnels. These are the animal versions of plasmodesmata in plants, for the same reason, to allow certain things to pass from one animal cell to the next. And they're found in different cells for different reasons, but there's a lot of them in your heart muscles, for instance. The cells of the heart need to contract. It's a muscle. But all of them need to contract more or less at the same time within a chamber in order for it to function efficiently as a pump. They can't all be getting short at different times, or it's just not going to work. It's not going to propel the blood through it. So flow of ions, which carry electrical charge, through gap junctions in heart muscle allow it to efficiently operate as a pump. Tight junction is shown in the top, and this one's bigger in terms of complexity because you only see part of it here. It's like a band of two-sided tape going all the way around one cell as a band, but also adhering to all the cells around it, like two-sided tape would. And even though it does hold the cells together, that's really not the main function. The job of holding cells together is the desmosome. Desmosome's job. The tight junction, though, if it's there, is a block to what is called the pericellular route. Now, up until now in this course, every time I've mentioned a membrane, I've been talking about a microscopic membrane, meaning smaller than a cell, the plasma membrane or a membrane of a membrane-bounded organelle. But we also use the word to describe a macroscopic thing. There are macroscopic membranes that are made out of many cells, like your skin, for instance. The epidermis of the skin is many cells, but it's considered one membrane, right? Well, let me just draw roughly a macroscopic membrane made out of, just two layers of cells. If you are a particle trying to get through that macroscopic membrane, then there are two possible routes you can take, called the cellular route and the paracellular route. The cellular route involves you actually entering a cell and then exiting it and going into the next cell through however many cells you need to, depending on how many layers there are, until you're finally through the overall macroscopic membrane. Paracellular gets its name because para means next to, like in paramedic. So the only difference there is that the particle that's trying to get through the macroscopic membrane never enters a cell. Instead, it squeezes in the spaces between cells until it's all the way through. Well, a tight junction prevents movement through the paracellular route, which is why it has to be all the way around the edge of the cell in order to work. You can see this red arrow. This indicates some particle that's trying to get through by the paracellular route. It can get a little bit into it, but then it hits the tight junction and can't. So overall, the macroscopic membrane, whatever tissue it's part of, if it has tight junctions, forces things to use the cellular route to get through. And only certain things can use the cellular route, because to take the cellular route means you have to be able to go through the plasma membrane of individual cells. And only certain things can do that, depending on the cell. All right, let's go to 30. Oh, 30 is the last slide. Typical summary slide. We've seen these before. I kept it in there for you to study with, but I'm not going to read it to you.